Well, hey, folks, and welcome to the season two premiere of the Texas Titans podcast. Happy New Year. It is already 2020. I hope you had an incredible Christmas and New Year, and I hope everything in 2019 pales in comparison to what you achieve in 2020. I'm so excited about the new year, and I'm really excited about the premiere episode of the new season, the second season of the Texas Titans podcast. My guest today is Jim Bayless. I'm excited about this for a number of reasons. One, Jim Bayless has led one of the most fascinating lives of anyone I've ever known. He was a University of Texas tennis player. He spent 30 years inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. as both a legislative aide as well as a lobbyist and attorney. He has played tennis as well as instructed everything from Supreme Court justices to Jerry Jeff Walker. He is a remarkable storyteller. He is a published author. He is, by all accounts, one of the most remarkable human beings I have ever had the pleasure of not only calling friend, but calling mentor. Now, if you've listened to the program for any time, you know that I love to reach out to my mentors and have them on the program because they are some of the most special people in my life, and I think they're some of the most accomplished people that I've ever known, and that's why they are my mentors. And I have just had the good fortune of being able to be a part of their lives and them a part of mine. And so as kind of a way to honor them and let you know who they are, I like to bring them on and pick their brains on the Texas Titan podcast. And this is, by all accounts, one of my favorites. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with my friend Jim Bayless. And I hope you have a great, great 2020. Please listen. I'm going to bring you as many, many fascinating guests as I possibly can. It's going to be a great season of the Texas Titans podcast. And anyway, it's 2020. Go crush it. Thanks, folks. Hey, folks, if you are in the Tyler area, and whether you live here or whether you're in town visiting, or if you're listening from Dallas Metroplex and you just want to get away, come on over to the Rose Capitol and have an incredible dinner. You know what? You probably would like to have a little culture in your life, right? Well, come to Culture ETX. It is a remarkable dining experience in downtown Tyler, Texas. Executive chef Lance McWhorter is one of the most talented culinary chefs I have ever met in my life, and he infuses everything from Middle Eastern cuisine to just good old Texas steaks to soul food, you name it. It's an eclectic mix like you've never experienced before. It's right in downtown Tyler, Texas. I have never had a bad meal at Culture, and I cannot more highly recommend going to Culture. Call for a reservation. They fill up quickly. The dining room is small. It's intimate. It's a fun, cool place to dine. The kitchen is literally right in the dining room, so you watch your meal get prepared. It's just an experience like no other in Tyler. So if you are in the area, go to Culture. And please, by all means, say, hey, I heard about you on the Texas Titans podcast. Jason Wright said that that I should try you out, and it would mean a lot to me. I know it would mean a lot to Lance. It's a great place. I want to see them succeed. So please go have an incredible dining experience at Culture in downtown Tyler. Thanks. All right. Well, James Bayless, Jim Bayless Esquire, as it were. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. I enjoy seeing you after too long.
Well, it's been far too long. And so this is the cool thing. So whenever I first started this podcast, I went to a lot of what I would consider mentors, right? And for the listener out there, you have to understand something. I've had the very, very good fortune of having great people come across my life that have influenced me, have poured into me, be it career, whatever. And this is the mentor of mentors. If my Yoda, as it were, Jim Bayless. So I have wanted to have this conversation so badly. I mean, it's really kind of, and I didn't plan this. I can't take credit for planning this, but this is probably going to be the last podcast of this year of 2019. And if ever there were a saving of best for last, it's this one. So I'm so good. I'm so glad to see you. I'm so glad that we're catching up like this. So thanks for making the time, Bayless.
Well, it's my pleasure. I caution you. I think you should aim higher in your choice of mentors, but perhaps this is one of those examples of where the low bid got the job.
Well, I don't know, man. I don't think I could do much better. But I tell you what. And here's the tough thing. I don't even know where to start. I mean, I've been really good at this with everybody else because you are undoubtedly one of the most accomplished, colorful, just one of these. You're like a Renaissance man, and I think that, you know, one of the things that you and I we share is that we're kind of like Forrest Gump. We do things, we end up in these circumstances that somehow, some way, success finds us. Although I think yours was a lot more deliberate, a lot more strategic than mine, most likely. But let's just start where it all began, because if ever there were a Houstonian, it is you and your family. So let's start in Houston, Texas, where the story begins, and just go from there.
All right. Well, first of all, if I'm a Renaissance man, just please don't ask me to spell it.
Oh, we'll talk about your wordsmithing later, and I know, because I know that would not be any trouble
but,
for you.
But I am a transplanted Houstonian, now living in Austin. I grew up in Houston. Certainly, this is quite clear through the rearview mirror, but it also was abundantly clear at the time that through no fault of my own and hardly based on any merit, I fell into a big tub of butter with regard to my family, my family's friendship circles, my parents' friends whose children were have been my lifelong friends. And it is simply phenomenal that so many of those friendships endure to this day, well more than half a century later, across the generations, and transcending the zip codes of Houston, but enveloping where I spent one-third of a century of my life, indeed, virtually all of my adult career in Washington, D.C., you know, 1,400 miles away from where we all grew up before repatriating about 9 years ago. But the Washington detour, as it were, followed, you know, my upbringing and adolescence and through my college experience at the University of Texas at Austin, and then law school at SMU. It was a bountiful experience, both educationally, but remarkably after hours as well, through the godsend, as it turned out, of an extracurricular activity called tennis. And it was through that medium where, like everybody else, when you're 8 or 9 years old, you forge friendships. Of course, this is when, you know, you're all have burr haircuts, knock knees, and braces and what have you. But those friendships endure. And so, thankfully, some of us had a modicum of success competitively. I was able to travel and play tournaments throughout the state of Texas, throughout the country, and throughout North America, all through college, where I attended the University of Texas at Austin on an athletic scholarship for tennis, majoring in accounting on the side. And I got interested in accounting with regard to one little sliver of it called tax, which impelled me to go to law school, not because I had any designs on being a lawyer, but I liked tax. So I went to SMU Law School, where there was a broader curriculum in tax law courses than there was at the University of Texas at Austin. Otherwise, pound for pound, the best law school in the state. So in any case, I emerged from all of that experience by the age of 25 with a law degree, and I go back to hometown of Houston and work for one of the then big eight CPA firms called Ernst & Ernst. It was about four name changes ago, mm-hmm. in doing tax compliance. And I enjoyed what I was doing, but I wasn't there for very long when the phone rang one day, an unexpected incoming call from Senator John Tower's office in Washington. So Senator Tower asked whether I would entertain the notion of moving to Washington. and serving as his legislative counsel, covering the Senate Finance Committee and some other things. Well, Senate Finance Committee is my sweet spot because that's the tax writing committee in the Senate. And I thought, well, that'd be pretty cool for a couple of years. So on my 26th birthday, I started my first day in Washington in the snow, for which I had to go out and buy an overcoat. I didn't know what overcoat was. Proceeded to work for Senator Tower for 3.5 years. And it was an eye-opening experience. It was incredibly educational, forging friendships through the substantive work or, again, after hours in Washington. Bear in mind that Washington is a very young town. People are from everywhere else. There are probably six people who are from Washington. So it is Ellis Island on the Potomac. You meet people from all over the country, all over the world, and you forge, in my case, lasting, enduring friendships, either spawned because of the substantive work that I was doing or purely extracurricular endeavors. So the timing ended up being serendipitous because as gratifying and rewarding as that early career opportunity was to be at ringside watching the sausage be made with regard to tax policy, which was what I enjoyed a lot, having grown up as the son of a prominent person in the securities business who would preach the gospel of free enterprise and capitalism before I could spell either of those phrases. So I emerged from the dining room table as a right-thinking, free enterprise, capitalistic, conservative fellow. So I sort of knew the grounding, and that was enhanced all the more by my 3.5 years working in the Senate. Well, lightning struck serendipitously again because in 1980, President Reagan won the White House, and three of us who worked for Senator Tower were very fortunate because we were on President Reagan's White House staff in the very beginning in 1981 and 82, which was infinitely rewarding in a different way. In Washington, it is, of course, a company town, three branches of government. There's a little bit of a private sector, or at least there was at that time. Now it's fairly robust in Washington. It's a high-tech corridor, among other things. But at the time, there are three gravitational pulls, either judiciary or legislative, the Congress, or the executive branch. So it is the checks and balances system in action, and you get to see it from various seats in the theater. So having witnessed it all from a legislative standpoint, then I was able to match that with a different perspective of executive branch experience, first in the White House, and then later I was tapped to be a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Congressional Affairs. But with regard to the White House experience, that too was very broadening and reinforcing to my worldview because given my interest and proclivity with regard to finance and economics and supply side tax policy, it was like shooting fish in the shooting fish in a barrel. In that I was in the Office of Presidential Personnel, which is the office, a very small office within the executive branch. The Executive Office of the Presidency in the White House that is responsible for the identification and selection and vetting of people to fill the policymaking positions throughout the executive branch. Now, let me give you a little perspective. The President of the United States, whoever the President is, has about 3,500 appointments. A scant few are subject to Senate confirmation. Those are the jobs you've heard of, the cabinet-level positions, and some assistant secretary positions, which is the second layer of the pyramid. But even though 3,500 sounds like a lot of positions, it only represents 1/7 of 1% of the total. So it's an infinitesimal share. Everybody else is civil service. So the importance of these policymaking positions that are subject to presidential appointment is that these are the people who have the car keys. The theory is that everybody in the executive branch, civil service included, will follow the leader. That is a nice theory if it is a Republican president. If it's a Democratic president, it is reality because, by and large, the civil service forces, at the risk of painting with too broad of a brush, are going to be predisposed to be left of center or certainly more liberal than the Republican candidate for president. And so they are joyous. And so everything is much more harmonious and it clicks. If it's a Republican president, the Republican president spends a great deal of time not only advancing his legislative agenda and agency policy direction, but also fighting a rear guard action with regard to what is often a hostile civil service. And given the disproportionate number of civil service people in the Department of XYZ or Agency ABC, it's easy to understand that it's very, very hard to advance the ball. So in any case, I was further aided in that chapter of my life by the fact that President Reagan's coattails were so enormously strong in the election of 1980 that the control of the Senate shifted from Democratic control. Democrats had controlled the Senate since 1954, but his Reagan's coattails were so incredibly powerful that it converted control of the Senate to the Republican column, picking up a net 12 seats, which is phenomenal. So it was wonderful because at least she had one of the two branches of Congress that was rowing in the same direction as President Reagan's policy agenda. So my responsibility in the Office of Presidential Personnel was the identification of people to fill these policymaking positions, and my slice of the pie were the money agencies. It was Treasury, the banking regulatory bodies, the international financial institutions like World Bank, IMF, what have you, and the regional development banks, and a few cats and dogs that are more money-oriented, such as the SEC. So the whole predicate of that is that policy is people. If you have the wrong people in these policy-making positions, you can blow a lot of policy. Therefore, it is the people that is the key ingredient. So with regard to my Republican and conservative prejudice, I knew what to look for. And fortunately, I'd been in Washington for 3.5 years at that point, so I was fairly street smart in the games people play. So I wasn't, babe in the woods with regard to some Machiavellian tricks that frequently are played by people seeking jobs. So my popularity was at an all-time high when I was in a position of perhaps paving the way for job placement in the Reagan administration. But it was a lot of fun and very gratifying, and we had a lot of successes in terms of people placement for policy advances. And then when I was tapped to be Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce, my responsibility was to advance the legislative agenda through Congress pertaining to the Reagan philosophy. And it was 99% international trade-related matters. So that was fine because I'd worked in the Senate before, and we achieved some strong measure of success in that lane of the racetrack. So all that was fantastic. I squeezed as much juice out of that lemon in what was 5 years altogether in government, Senate plus White House plus a very large department, and I wanted to get a real job, so I jumped to the private sector and practiced law in the Washington office of a very large Texas-based law firm by the name of Akin Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld. And the significance of that is two or threefold. First, it was a lot of Texans. And even though I was living and working in Washington, my ties back to my home state of Texas remained extremely strong. Having worked for a senator from Texas, I'd go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so my Texas credentials and passport were very strongly identified wherever I went. So in the private sector, it was a win for me, and again, sort of a Forrest Gump experience in that our client base was essentially representing, you know, corporate America across all sorts of industry lines, clients that have their ox in a ditch with regard to either a legislative threat or a regulatory threat. You have to realize that 99% of that which happens in Washington is a threat to some interest, economic interest, an entrenched interest. Tax policy, for example, who is not affected by federal tax policy? If you are if you're a company in a regulated industry, it's going to be regulated at the federal level. Think of the Food and Drug Administration, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Interstate Commerce Commission back in the day when it existed. So the regulatory threat from these federal overseers, both in terms of departments and agencies or Congress, is it's ever-present. It not only could affect the economic interests of a given company in a direct way, like, you know, tax rates being increased, for example, or it could imbalance the playing field with regard to other companies that are your competitors within an industry. So Congress loves to pick winners and losers. And so that, in my estimation, is a no-no. But being with a large firm had its great advantages because the rainmaker extraordinaire who was so closely identified with Akin Gump was Bob Strauss. Bob Strauss, very prominent Democrat. And I might add, by the way, that I was the only Republican doing any legislative work in the whole firm. But it was great in that it was a Republican Senate where I'd worked, and it was a Republican executive branch. So please throw me the ball. Throw me in that briar patch. I loved it. And so the firm involved me in a great number of things with regard to clients that ran the gamut in terms of industry. I guess, without question, some of the more celebrated clients that I worked with and for as part of teams within the firm included the Hollywood production community, where, lo and behold, I was the lawyer who had responsibility for Mary Tyler Moore and Edith Bunker, Jean Stapleton of TV fame, All in the Family. And on the other end of the spectrum, in the energy policy arena at that time, probably the dominant headline in 1984 was the oil company takeover frenzy, which was a very disconcerting thing to many people in the country, particularly if you were CEOs of major integrated oil companies, and these corporate raiders, these Darth Vaders, who would come in out of left field and use evil junk bonds to wrest control of the major oil company. And so specifically, we represented Boone Pickens with Mesa Petroleum. And so that was a lot of fun, as you can imagine, very high-profile stuff in a totally different arena from the arcane Federal Communications Commission regulatory matter that involved all the Hollywood stars and TV stars that I mentioned earlier. So not every client matter had tremendous sex appeal, but it was a very, very rewarding segment for a few years for me. But there comes a time when you realize that as an associate lawyer at a big law firm, you're really just like yet another oarsman in Ben-Hur. And the ship's captain forever wants you to row faster and row faster and row faster. Even if you break a world record, you're supposed to row faster. So there comes a moment when you figure, you know, I might be able to do this myself on my own. So I jumped out of the nest, and with another couple of people, a couple of partners, we started our own small firm. And I had my own firm doing essentially the same type of work for decades thereafter. So my Washington experience was, you know, very blessed with regard to clients that were very enjoyable, some very technical. If I were a doctor, I think it would be fair to say that I'd be like a GP, a general practitioner, in that I probably at one time or another was exposed to virtually every industry there is, certainly every regulatory department and agency that there is, maybe with the exception of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But you just have to learn the substance. The reason a client would hire me or a big firm in Washington if their interests were affected and threatened by regulatory or legislative action is not to tell them about their own business. They know their own business. A sometimes challenging fact that we had to learn in a hurry, but they hire us because we understand the processes. And we, once we get grounded in their profession, their industry, and their corporate interests, for example, we know how to translate that into a strategy that will either improve the odds of outright victory, either in defeating a bad regulatory threat, or perhaps notching a win and getting something affirmative accomplished. But more often than not, what usually happens is you end up, good fortune, you end up making the situation less bad than it would have been otherwise, and then you can declare victory with a straight face. So it was a terribly rewarding experience to have developed this client base across industry lines and indeed across the world. We were very lucky to have developed client relationships with a number of companies in Europe, which enabled me to go back and forth there just as much as we did to and from Texas. So it was very, very rewarding. There was no guarantee that any of that was going to work out on day one. There are some white knuckle moments when you first hang out your shingle, because try as we might to find a client that would be willing to sign a retainer agreement in perpetuity, that client remained elusive. We could never find one that would sign up forever. So a lot of times you work yourself out of a job by succeeding, but it's a word of mouth business. And so the clients, fortunately, come in the front door, the side door, or over the transom by word of mouth. So it's looking back, we were very blessed to have had the success that we did.
Well, you did, but you know, that brings up a great point though, Jim, in that one of the things that you are a master of is the network, which here's the thing too that I've mentioned on this podcast before, is because whether I'm talking to undergrads who, like we talked about a minute ago, that I'm now mentoring, or whether it's just anybody in general in business, networking is really friend making if you're going to do it right, which you have done an impeccable job with. And that's one of the things I, you know, whenever I describe you, I'm like, you know, I talk about all the things, you know, with humor, your success, but also you've got one of the largest Rolodexes in all of Texas and beyond. Talk to the listener a little bit about, because this is one of the things I want to do with this podcast always, is to give, especially those, in, whether they're starting, midpoint, or wherever they are in their career, those tips and those things that are very important for success. And I got to believe, while you were inside the Beltway making those treks through the different agencies, through the executive branch, that that had to have benefited you when it came time to put out that proverbial shingle of your own. Talk about what your process is whenever it comes to maintaining, establishing and maintaining relationships for the long haul, not just so transactional based, because, you know, you meet a lot of people in business that are like that. It's just it's a transaction. Right. You know, you're going to be my friend until we get this deal done. Then you may or may not ever hear from me. I'm a great example of someone that there's little to nothing I could ever do to benefit you, but you have been such a good friend and mentor to me. And you've kind of shown me how you maintain those long-time friendships. What has been your strategy? And just talk about the benefits that that has yielded throughout your career.
Well, that's an excellent point. This is how I would answer that question, because this is precisely what I tell the cascade of young 20-somethings or even college students in mentoring them, as I do today and have for, you know, probably 15 years altogether. The way I would start the explanation is by pointing out that, you know, you can't know too many people. You just flat can't. And it is Washington, as I said before, it is a conglomeration of people from all over the kingdom, far beyond and far more diversified than hometown USA. So it is a bountiful buffet table where you can meet and befriend an enormous circle of people from different backgrounds, different ages, different viewpoints. And I tried to be a sponge, not to say I didn't have my own viewpoints on the issue of the day, but as one of my mentors who was a renowned member of the U.S. Senate and who coincidentally was President Reagan's closest personal friend was Paul Laxalt, Senator from Nevada. And on paper, there is no way in the world that I ever should have met Paul Laxalt even once, much less become such a dear friend for many decades. He told me one time, and he was immensely popular and respected across the aisle. He was in the Senate for 12 years. He had been governor of Nevada before that, attorney general of the state of Nevada before that. And he was beloved from the leftmost point on the spectrum politically to the rightmost point politically. And he put it to me this way. He said, you know, I tried never to personalize my policy differences. Now, that is in stark contrast to today.
Absolutely.
But it is the watchword that I think of every single day, sometimes several times a day, as to how to bring some degree of harmony back to contemporary Washington. You can be passionate about your views of the day on this issue or that, but there's no real necessity of poisoning the soup of your opponent on that issue, because the fact is today's allies may include tomorrow's opposition, and today's opponent might be tomorrow's allies. There's always a tomorrow. So why would you poison the well forevermore by breaking your pick on the issue on Tuesday when you're going to be in the same Senate chamber on Thursday and maybe for several years together? So back then, I guess as a down payment on the explanation of why it seemed to work all right back then when there were still passionate differences of opinion on public policy matters, and why it just simply does not work seemingly today at all. Well, back then, when I was working in the Senate and observing all this early in my career and being a sponge watching these titans on the Senate floor, and there were titans, both left as well as right. You had giants on the Washington stage. You had George McGovern, Hubert Humphrey, Teddy Kennedy on the left. And on the right, you had Jesse Helms, Strom Thurmond. And it just went on and on and on. But there were some towering figures. John Glenn, astronaut. There were some towering figures. So, you're in awe of these people. But they might differ on the issue du jour, but they would be very friendly to each other because they recognized that there's no point in being other than friendly. So most of those members of the Senate back then were members of the Greatest Generation. And overriding everything was a recognition, regardless of ideological stripe, that, by God, George McGovern, he may have some wacky ideas on policy, but he flew 30 B-29 missions in World War II to protect my family. That trumped everything. So therefore, you need to get back to that personal slash political dichotomy and not allow that to poison your personal relationships. So that is numero uno. The another facet in my experience that that you touched on in teeing up the question is this is a remarkable skeleton key that served me so well that it's hard to describe. And that is the unlikely universal passport that my tennis past happened to play in my professional life. And that is everybody seems to, certainly back then, if not today, seems to love to play tennis. So being a better than average tennis player, you were highly sought after to play tennis with these people who whose number one priority, frankly, is tennis. Their ostensible job in the day is to be a member of the Supreme Court of the United States or the President of the United States or cabinet officials or senators or what have you. But by God, their first priority in their Walter Mitty lives is they really want to be professional tennis players. So they can't do that, so they settle for being Chief Justice, for example.
Which is funny because, as you know, we have a mutual friend that's a real story. He's clerking for a Supreme Court justice who says, meet me like at noon or whatever. They say to play tennis. And this individual, this United States senator now, clerk then, had never held a tennis racket, I don't think, and probably never should hold a tennis racket today.
That's exactly right. But the tennis ended up being this wild card, a skeleton key that opened up so many doors for me, it was uncanny. And I would be on speed dial phone calls. Of course, this is eons before email. But my phone would ring at 11:30 at night, waking me up from a deep, dark sleep. And it would be George Mitchell, the Senate Majority Leader, asking if I could play tennis at 7 o'clock the next morning. Of course, the answer is yes. I played at the ultra private, all but unknown indoor tennis court on the fifth floor of the Dirksen Senate office building. I christened it along with Senator Bennett Johnston from Louisiana, whom I played tennis with, as I did with Senator Laxalt, probably, I'd say, at least once a week, every week, in both cases, for 29 or 30 years. But I would play frequently with Teddy Kennedy, and all sorts of people whom you would not put in the same sentence with me politically. But again, who cares about that? And I tell you, when you get to know and befriend people through this extracurricular activity of tennis, you forge genuine, authentic relationships with these people. And it has nothing to do with what they do for a living. It has nothing to do with what you do for a living. Although, of course, sometimes, occasionally, those jobs might intersect, and I might have a client matter that is pending before the Senate Commerce Committee, the ranking Democrat or chairman of which happens to be a senator or House member who is a tennis friend. Well, that doesn't hurt. They don't necessarily do what I would have them do in favor of my client just because we have a personal relationship, because you have to prove your case. And so there's no getting around that. But it certainly warms the atmosphere to have these kind of genuine relationships, which if you play your cards right, endure. And long after some of these people are in public office, you know, I put my feet under their dinner table more times than I can count, until, you know, like Senator Laxalt died a year ago, August, at age 96. But I was in touch with him all the time, even after we moved to Austin. And I still am in touch with his widow at least once or twice, three times a month. And so that's the value. So I tell the younger generation, I said, meet everybody you can. Now, parenthetically, you don't have to like them all, but just let that be your little secret if you don't. But maintain these relationships. These people are going to come back in your life to a remarkable extent at a time and in a context that will blow your mind. And if you do the friendly thing of keeping the pot stirred, it will be incredibly rewarding. And it is fun on top of that.
I could not agree more. And you know, you'll love this story because I don't think I've told you this one. So whenever I made my congressional bid, I was in Houston for a fundraiser, and in that room was the person who is responsible for our friendship, John Atkins, okay? Well, not only that, but I had, I guess if you're doing like the network tree, I had four generations there, because Brownie Baker, first cousin to James Baker, which is why I knew John. So Brownie was there, Atkins was there, Atkins, who had introduced me to you, had also introduced me to Ted Cruz. We were all in the room together, and I remember, and that was over a 20-year process that all happened, from whenever meeting Brownie to meeting John to meeting Ted and meeting you. And so what you say, I have lived that, and you never ever know when those relationships will resurface, and it's a lot easier whenever you truly do value them and turn it into a friendship versus, well, and like I've talked about in this podcast before, you know, if you're 45 years old and you lose your job, your company sold, whatever the case may be, and you have not nurtured that network, or you have just viewed it as a transactional endeavor, good luck trying to make those calls. But now, one of the things I want to talk about too is kind of your life outside of the paid work, because one of my favorite things that you do is, are you still on the State Cemetery Commission?
I mean, yes. That's kind of your passion. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes.
All right. Here's why I want to bring this up, because what this audience needs to understand is that you are inevitably one of the best storytellers that I've ever known in my life. And so I want you to just, and the thing is too, the State Cemetery, who a lot of people don't even know it's a thing, much less the fact that that is like where Chris Kyle is buried, and if I remember correctly from my personal tour, is the most visited gravesite at this point, right? Mm-hmm. Tell the listeners some of the cool stories about the State Cemetery and why, I'm telling you, why they should absolutely, should they come to Austin, go to the State Cemetery? And how did you get involved with it? How did that come to play?
Okay, so I will eagerly address all of that. One footnote on the prior topic about the imperative of meeting everybody you possibly can and befriending them, particularly total strangers. I have a couple of other illustrations. Your contemporaries who work down the hall from you, if you're working as a staffer in the Senate or a staffer at the White House or whatever, these people might be your age at age 26 or 27 or 29, but their lives are not going to end at that point. For example, and it's such a bountiful reward to have forged friendships at a young age, at a time when it is beyond any foreseeability as to what these other people are going to become. For example, one of my blood brothers, whom I did not know at all until I arrived on day one on the White House staff, was the low man on the totem pole in the White House counsel's office. Well, lo and behold, he was from Tyler, Texas. And so I could tell by his East Texas accent. So being one of the Texan his age, just down the hall, we became pals, despite being in different offices. Well, time marches on. He becomes a big wheel at the Justice Department. He is appointed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the Virginias and the Carolinas and Maryland. And he has this parade of young law clerks, whom I would get to know when they would come through the revolving door and serve their one-year clerkship for Judge Mike Luttig. Then Mike ended up being the runner-up to John Roberts in the competition to be named Chief Justice following the death of Chief Justice William Rehnquist in 2005. John Roberts separately and I were friends because we were all just a bunch of running buddies, you know, beer drinking buddies, cheeseburger eating buddies when we were young. But it was, if you had told any of us at that time that John would become Chief Justice of the United States, Mike Luttig would be a judge on the Fourth Circuit, and then bridesmaid but not a bride to become Chief Justice himself. And for the last 15 years, general counsel of an outfit called Boeing, it's just phenomenal. Now, how did I know these people? Well, you just meet them, and you pay attention, and you take notes. Another client matter that ripened into one of the most remarkable weeks, actually it was two different years, but two different experiences, because of the tennis. In my prior life, I was buddies with some of the Swedish tennis players, and I'd met one of these old Swedish tennis players at an event in the Caribbean. And he called me about a year later and said he was doing some work for Scandinavian Airlines. And he asked whether, and Scandinavian Airlines was about to inaugurate nonstop service to the East Coast, to Newark, between Stockholm and Newark. And they wisely had harnessed a lot of the Swedish tennis players of note to be roving ambassadors for SAS, Scandinavian Airlines. And so he asked whether they might be able to put on a tennis event, exhibition, or pro-celebrity event in Washington. So I said, well, of course, we can help on that. This is during the time that President George H.W. Bush was in the White House. President Bush was an absolute tennis nut. And so we had back-to-back phenomenal events at the White House tennis court with, you know, Bjorn Borg and a host of Swedish tennis players. And then, lo and behold, shortly thereafter, I was hired by SAS to do some legal work. So you never know. So, you know, these things are going to come in over the transom. And you can't just lock yourself in the law library and expect for all that to happen. So thank goodness for that. Now, forgive the digression and footnote on the prior topic.
Which I might mention because I wish that we, you know, I love your book. Washington on Rye, which is a phenomenal read, but it's, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be of the friends and family, one of the friends that got a copy because it has not been mass published, which I am going to do everything in my power to change that because I think it's an incredible book about just the inside the Beltway. And you mentioned George Herbert Walker Bush. You grew up playing tennis with the first President Bush. What was that like, and what was he like as a child? Whenever you, as a child, and having him as a neighbor and a tennis
player? talk about this gets back to the first sentence of my spiel. Talk about being incredibly fortunate from virtually birth with my family and my parents' friendship circles. It manifested in what you just now suggest. When George and Barbara Bush and their kids moved from Midland, Texas to Houston in 1959, Mr. and Mrs. Bush fell into the same social circles and indeed the same neighborhood as where we lived and a lot of my parents' social friends and who had kids who were my social friends or tennis friends or classmates in elementary school. And lo and behold, so we all knew one another quite well. And this is back in an era when parents knew all their friends' kids. And indeed, it was in an era long ago when anybody else's dad could discipline anybody else's kid. So those were the good old days.
Right.
So I forged a very close, Harley was unique in this respect, but I had a very close friendship with Mr. and Mrs. Bush, enhanced by the fact that Jeb Bush and I were in fourth grade together. And then, fast forward, even after he had gone off to prep school at Andover, he came back to college at the University of Texas, and where I was playing tennis on the varsity team. And we had 11 members on our team, and our coach said, well, why don't we try to recruit one additional player just so we have an even dozen. So I suggested, well, there was this fellow that I grew up with playing tennis in Houston who's a very good player, and let's see if he passes muster, he can be a walk-on, a tryout. And so Jeb Bush not only went to the University of Texas, a little-known fact, when he was running for governor of Florida, much less when he was running for the presidency of the United States, people are amazed that they associated him with Florida, not Houston, Texas. They're amazed that he went to the University of Texas. They're even more surprised to learn that he played tennis at the University of Texas. But yet they say, well, why is it that he just played for one semester? And I said, well, because he graduated from college in 2.5 years in the most daunting curriculum, liberal arts program that there is to offer called Plan 2. So you never know. And so fast forward, lo and behold, Mr. Bush is vice president of the United States. Well, that kind of family friendship didn't expire back in Texas, and the Bushes were incredibly hospitable and inclusive of us knucklehead Houston kids who happened to live in Washington at the time. And there were, a handful of us, childhood friends in Houston, who by one means or another happened to fall into Washington. And we were with the Bushes a great deal. And Mr. Bush was a tennis-aholic. And I'd get calls Sunday morning at 7:45 saying, Bailey, can you come over here, Naval Observatory, 20 minutes. So, we were on call. And then we became president of the United States. We, beyond our wildest imagination, found ourselves playing tennis at the White House court, a great deal. So it's just, you never know. But none of that would have happened. None of those experiences ever would have happened if I had been a hermit and been scared of my own shadow. So it gets back to my original statement about advice to the younger generation. You never know what's going to happen. So, buy your ticket and take your chances. There's no downside at all.
Well, and there's one thing I want to get to before we talk about some state cemetery stories, because you just prompted something in my mind, because you and I have discussed this before. Because this is the Texas Titans podcast, as a fifth generation Texan, I'm pretty partial to the state, as I know you are. Talk about the role that Texas played whenever you were working in D.C., but now just the influence the Lone Star State has on the political scene, the goings-on in Washington, because for those Texans, you know, we have people that listen from outside the state, but it is the Texas Titans podcast, and I'm kind of proud of the influence that is wielded by this the Lone Star State. So talk a little bit about that.
That's an excellent point. All right, here's the deal. When you're saturated with Texana, as I was in Washington, D.C., it is a tremendous source of pride, because to say that you're a proud Texan is redundant. There's also a lot of envy by those from 49 other states, because Texas has an aura about it that few, if any, other states can come close to matching. Jealousy is part of it, perhaps, but it's envy. Texas has been blessed with a tremendous base of natural resources, a tremendous base of human resources, a tremendous base of political resources for, you know, decades and decades and decades and decades. By the luck of the draw, there have been so many Texans who have had a pronounced influence on not only the body politic, but the direction of the country, both politically, economically, and in many other ways. Name a president with a larger than life persona, notwithstanding different political parties from my own. Lyndon Johnson. He cast a very, very wide and deep shadow. On the congressional front, Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House. Few people wielded the kind of power that Sam Rayburn wielded. Again, at a time when the Democratic Party ruled the roost during all of the New Deal era and beyond. Jim Wright, ultimately Speaker of the House, Democrat, the third most powerful position in all of American government. Goes on and on and on. My first boss, John Tower, Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. George H.W. Bush, before he was Vice President, he was his first elected position was Chairman of the Harris County Republican Party. Then he was elected to the House.
Okay, so we are back with Jim Bayless. And to the listener, they probably don't even know that we came to an abrupt halt, but your podcast host did not erase enough memory on his SIM card before starting the interview. So I had just asked Jim about what it means to be a part of the Texas delegation, because Texas is unique in character and stature, and we had gotten he kind of ticked off a list of the dignitaries such as Sam Rayburn and LBJ, larger than life figure, and then we had gotten to George Herbert Walker Bush, who Jim, you were just describing, had become a congressman. So pick up from there on again George H.W. Bush and his legacy, and just all of the shadow that Texas casts upon the rest of all of Washington.
Right. Well, the metaphor of shadow is right on the money. Historically, Texas has had an enormous impact on national affairs. Not only the luminaries that people know by sight and by name, ranging from, you know, Sam Rayburn, Lyndon Johnson, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was born in Texas, by the way. Yep. And, you know, the two Bush presidents, but also some other luminaries that are not as easily remembered, but who nonetheless had a tremendous impact. Jim Wright, congressman from, you know, Fort Worth and Weatherford, Texas, was Speaker of the House, the third most powerful position in the U.S. government. But also there have been a number of committee chairmen who have been vastly powerful. You know, there was, you know, Mahon from West Texas, chairman of the House Appropriations Committee for years and years. John Tower, of course, was chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So, you know, it just goes on and on and on. Now, Mr. Bush, who ran for the U.S. Senate in 1964, unsuccessfully at first, against Ralph Yarborough, did very well for the Republican Party at the time, because there were only about seven or eight Republicans in the state of Texas back then, more than half a century ago. But Mr. Bush, 2 years later, was successful in winning a congressional seat in a newly created congressional district in Houston. And then he was reelected in 66. So he served 4 years in the House. And remarkably, he was tapped right off the bat as a freshman to the House Ways and Means Committee, which is, you know, which was extraordinary for a rookie to be tapped to the most, you know, one of the most two powerful committees in the U.S. House. And then he ran again for the Senate in 1970 against his former opponent of 6 years before, Ralph Yarborough. However, Ralph Yarborough was upset in the primary, Democratic primary, by Lloyd Benson, who went on to, by the way, I should enumerate Senator Benson as, you know, a tremendously powerful member of the Texas congressional shadow, as you described, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, excuse me, Senate Finance Committee, and then later Secretary of the Treasury. So, you know, it's hard to remember all of the distinguished Texans in Washington. It just goes on and on and on. And so Mr. Bush, after he served in the House, lost in the Senate general election in 1970, but that began what for him was the predicate for his very successful role in foreign affairs in multiple capacities. Thanks to being appointed by Presidents Nixon and Ford, but, first as chairman of the Republican National, well, first, you know, it was, I can't remember the sequence because it all is so extraordinary, but he was chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was ambassador to the United Nations. He was the first emissary, the de facto ambassador to the People's Republic of China. And director of the CIA. Now, one would be hard pressed to find anybody in American history who had a background that better prepared somebody to be first Vice President of the United States and then President of the United States. And he was just, you know, exceptional. So the power, and then of course, you know, his son, George W., was elected in the year 2000. That was the second time that a father-son tandem had been president of the United States in you know, over, you know, almost two centuries, from John Adams and John Quincy Adams. So again, the Texas aura is quite mighty. Now, that cuts both ways. In my own personal experience, having been in Washington across, you know, six presidencies altogether, where the tide has been coming in and the tide is going out in terms of power, Republican majority in the Senate and a Republican executive branch, but then a great portion of that period of time, the tide was out because Democrats ruled the roost in the executive branch as well as legislative branch. So the flip side of all of this distinguished company that I enumerate is that while Texans can rightly be tremendously proud of that heritage, regardless of party stripe, I might add, just in terms of sheer megatonnage and clout to get things done, It's very, very significant in the annals of American history. The flip side, though, is that being one of the Texans running around Washington, either when I worked on Capitol Hill or in the Reagan White House, is that there was a lot of envy, and indeed you can call it jealousy. So people seemingly were always gunning for Texans. They took there was a lot of Schadenfreude when a Texan slipped and fell, mm-hmm. or hit a banana peel. So there was this rivalry, sort of below the waterline, if you will, that was quite manifest.
Yeah.
But you know, that's their problem.
Well, and I want to back up one a little bit there, because you know, Jim, you knew the Bush family intimately. I mean, you grew up literally with, like you said, with Jeb. Y'all were friends. You played tennis with George Herbert Walker Bush. And if ever there was a family that lived in the political space but was just, it seemed to me, respected and admired, and even if they were like, even I don't care what side of the aisle you're on, it seems like there's a genuine affection for the Bush family. That, I mean, and look, even in our, you know, as Republicans, even inside our party, the Bushes take, you know, hit after hit after hit. You know, whether but yet, whenever you just get right down to them as people, all you hear about is these are just wonderful folks. Talk a little bit about your perspective, having known the Bushes for so long and what they meant to you in your life, and just kind of who they were as people. And what was it going, I guess, back to Prescott Bush was who kind of started the whole act of public service, with what is it about the Bush family that they have, while they've had financial success or business success, rather, to put it better, they've always seemed to take it into public service at some level. And you see that even with the later generations coming up, they're doing the same thing. What is it about the Bushes that make them so special?
Well, they personify decency on a personal level and class as a matter of integrity. I think of the tagline of Sara Lee pastry products. Nobody doesn't like mm-hmm. Sara Lee. Mm-hmm. Nobody doesn't like any member of the Bush family. Right. Both Mr. Bush, Barbara Bush, George W. Bush, Jeb Bush, the rest of the Klan, they never personalized their policy differences. The friendships went across the aisle, and they were genuine. I'll tell you an anecdote that I think is the thumbnail sketch of what you're getting at. Consider what the Secret Service agents think who are on the presidential detail. Consider what Secret Service agents themselves think of the person and family whose life their career is to protect.
Right.
Okay, so when Mr. Bush was Vice President of the United States, he absolutely deliberately did not leave Washington until December the 26th. Why? To go back to Houston, which mm-hmm. he typically did. Mm-hmm. So that his protective detail, the Secret Service, could spend Christmas Day with their families.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can actually, and it's interesting, when you went down that road, so my first home I ever owned in Houston, I live next door to a member of the Secret Service. He was actually a guy named Gary Moore, who's still with the Secret Service. He'll retire there. He's been there over 30 years now. And he was actually on Mrs. Bush's, Barbara Bush's, detail for some time. And he had to protect Clinton at different times. He had to protect I don't think he ever protected Al Gore, but he had some interesting stories about that detail. But he said that both George H.W. and Barbara were the most beloved
individuals by the Secret Service detail for that exact reason. He said they were so kind. They were so considerate of the personnel that were protecting them as well as their families. And I mean, it was really, really cool to listen to, which by contrast, and I'm not going to call any names, I don't want to bash anyone on the podcast to try to keep it, you know, above the belt, but there was one individual who was never president, but he was second in command, or second in line, rather. There's really no command with the vice presidency, I suppose, unless there's a tie vote. But there was one individual that they said that literally his last day in office as vice president, all the Secret Service volunteered to cover that detail that day just because they had such disdain for this individual. They wanted to be there the last day to say goodbye in their own special way.
but
the Bushes, they loved. They all said they did. Loved
Well, and I knew a lot of agents who were on the presidential protective detail as well as the vice presidential protective detail over the years. And as a group, it is unequivocal that the Secret Service agents adored the Reagans.
Yep.
They absolutely worshipped George and Barbara Bush, and they had the same admiration for George and Laura Bush as they did for Dick and Lynn Cheney, I might add. But the contrast of that humanness, that consideration, that inclusiveness and dignity and friendliness and the apolitical nature of their relationships with these individuals was off the charts in those cases.
Yeah.
Can't speak to everybody, all presidents of both parties, but I can tell you that that is absolutely the case with regard to the Reagans and both Bush families.
Well, okay, so, and I think it's fascinating that you've spent so much of your life being in kind of the man behind the power, the man behind the scenes, making things happen in D.C., and you and I, we both share such an affinity for not only the political realm, but also our beloved state of Texas, and one of your most, one of my favorite things about you in your background is your role with the state cemetery, which, like I said before we got on, is, you know, there's listeners that are going to hear this that don't even know that there is a state cemetery, much less what the heck it is. And it is, I'm just going to tell you, listener, if you're ever in Austin, save a trip to the Hula Hut. You can always do that. Sixth Street will always be there. You can always watch the bats from outside the Four Seasons. You can do all that. I'm with you, fine. But if you do nothing else, go to the state cemetery. And if you're fortunate enough to be there at a day that my brother from another mother, Jim Bayless, is hosting and doing a tour, there's nothing like it. I think this is where your artisanship as a storyteller reaches its zenith, Jim. It's awesome to get to take a tour of the cemetery with you. So first of all, talk about what the state cemetery is, a little bit of the history, and then just some of those anecdotal stories, because what I love the most is hearing you talk about people who literally won't be buried in certain places in the cemetery due to their proximity to political rivals or whatever. Then the Chris Kyle grave, which has become the most visited site in the cemetery. Just give us a little bit of what the state cemetery is, what it means to you, and how you got involved.
All right. The Texas State Cemetery is a jewel in the crown of Texas like no other. Significantly, Texas is the only state in the Union that has its own state cemetery to honor its heroes and other luminaries. And it's been there since 1851. And it's quite convenient. It's only about a half a mile to the east of downtown Austin, between 7th and 11th Streets. It's 18 acres that is absolutely gorgeous. It is not just a military cemetery like Arlington. A lot of people think that is the case, but it is an active cemetery. Even though it's been there for, you know, quite some time, more than a century and a half, it is not, but, you know, I'd say, you know, 75% full, if you will. In addition to those who were buried there, other people are they have reservations, shall we say. One day they will be buried there. And of course, the litmus test is whether the person has been has brought distinction upon the state of Texas in any number of capacities. It could be art, architecture, athletics, education, jurisprudence, military, government service, ranching, oil and gas, music, aeronautics. It just runs the gamut. So to give you a flavor of the names that one might easily recognize, you know, there are names that are identifiable and names that you've never heard of. And of course, they're rogues and scoundrels because that is what makes Texas, Texas. So, you know, Stephen F. Austin, the father of Texas. James Michener is memorialized there. You know, J. Frank Dobie, Fred Gibson, the author of Old Yeller. But more recently, Chris Kyle, the Navy sniper and SEAL. It was one of the most overwhelming burial services I've ever witnessed, with 100 Navy SEALs in attendance, wow. Each of whom hammered their own SEAL, Navy SEAL chevron into the top of the casket. And when all that was done, the top of the casket was solid gold. Gene Cernan, the astronaut, the last man to walk on the moon, who died almost 3 years ago, come next month. Herb Kelleher, the co-founder and longtime CEO of Southwest Airlines.
Which, by the way, I'm going to pause real quick.
Yes.
That was Jim Bayless who convinced, because Herb was born in New York, correct? Was he a New York?
New Jersey.
Yeah, New Jersey, right. Yeah, but he was convinced by Jim Bayless to be buried in...
That's right. So the reason that I happen to have this walking around knowledge about the state cemetery is that there is a state cemetery committee that was found, was formed when George W. Bush was governor of Texas. And there are three people on the committee, and the governor approves all of them, but the governor picks the person, and the lieutenant governor picks the person, and the Speaker of the House picks the person. And so I was recommended by Joe Strauss, then the Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, who parenthetically had been an intern in his youth for Senator John Tower in Washington. So, you know, history repeats in terms of public service, which, by the way, is a footnote on what I meant to add when I was discussing President George H.W. Bush. What drove him and drove Jeb and drove George W. into the realm of government is their absolute divine view that there is an obligation of public service. Mm-hmm. And that sounds corny today, but by God, it's the future that every younger generation member of the country has got to appreciate, because if you so belittle that, you know, heaven help you.
Yeah,
it's vital. And so those supposedly corny notions of public service actually are genuine and they're vital. So back to the state cemetery. So I've been on the committee for 7 years, and I got re-upped a couple of years ago, so I have another several years. But in addition to the names you'll recognize, Stephen F. Austin, Gene Cernan, Chris Kyle, Herb Kelleher, there are 14 governors of the state of Texas. There are justices of the Texas Supreme Court and other judges, state judges. Bill Powers died in the spring of 2019 as president of the University of Texas at Austin. Mickey LeMaitre, Dr. LeMaitre, former chancellor of the UT system. Don Baylor, the Major League Baseball hero with Baltimore Orioles, who later was the manager of the Colorado Rockies. There are so many people that whose biographies are simply overwhelming, and they together they present a mosaic of the history of Texas, mm-hmm. because it's not just in one context. As I said, the categories go from A to Z. People who have, done enormous things in medicine, and you know, the some of the there's one unsung hero who comes to mind, whose gravestone starts off by reciting all these oil and gas patents, and you're reading down these sort of bullet points, if you will, and you know, oil and gas patent, oil and gas patent, oil and gas patent, and you think, okay, well, fine, he was an oil and gas, you know, expert. Then you read further, survival of the invasion of Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
Then you read further, survivor of the Battle of the Bulge. This is the same human being.
Wow.
It's just simply overwhelming. Wow. How do you manage to survive Pearl Harbor and the Battle of the Bulge?
Yeah.
Who does that? It's simply overwhelming. And so, and then there are about 3,500 Civil War veterans and their widows, because if you're approved for burial, well, first of all, they're those who were automatically eligible for burial there, members of the state legislature, past or present, state elected officials. If you're a U.S. senator from Texas, you know, you qualify as an automatic. You don't have to be buried there, but it's not a family cemetery, so you can, you know, you get your spouse, but it's not, you know, for all of your kids right. as well. So in any case, there are, in my recruiting efforts, if you will, other than Herb Kelleher, you know, I've arranged for certain other dignitaries to be either buried there in their sweet time. There's no hurry on any of this. Coupon does not expire. But Ken Starr, of course, who's a yep. native Texan, who was a close friend of mine in Washington. Carl Rove, former deputy chief of staff in the White House in the Bush 43 administration. Another person who is not who died a few years ago, who is not buried at the state cemetery, but who nonetheless will be memorialized there soon, is Dr. Denton Cooley. He's buried in Houston at Glenwood. But all of these people have brought enormous fame and attention to the state of Texas. And I say Texas is the only state with such a cemetery, which, in my humble opinion, unbiased opinion, is the way it should be.
Are you going to be buried there? Are you going to go to Houston?
I could be.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm gonna call an audible.
Okay. Well, I was just curious because you know you are such a Houstonian among Houstonians as well yeah. as I mean if ever there was somebody who has would be I would think you know qualified or whatever.
I've been approved, but. We'll see. Well, I'll pull that. I'll make that decision. You know, next 40 or 50 years.
Well, and here's the real reason for my asking, which I think kind of lends credibility to my podcast, is that should you decide to, didn't you say that Ruth Simmons is she?
Yes, indeed.
Who is a Texas Titan who I've interviewed on the podcast, the president exactly. of Texas Prairie View A&M, and
exactly. And then also another person that sort of bridges my past and then this immediate context of the Texas State Cemetery. But not long ago, the committee approved application for burial at the State Cemetery of Jerry Jeff Walker.
Oh, as they should.
And the coincidence is that I gave him tennis lessons when he would pass through Washington at one performance or another, and quite a character, needless to say. So, you know, it takes all kinds, and Texas has all kinds.
Absolutely, it most certainly does. And that's the thing that I was so excited about getting you on this show, Bayless, is because you understand and are able to describe those stories as well, if not better, than anyone I've ever met. Now, and also as it relates to the cemetery, now, George and Laura, because they've already picked out their sites, correct?
Well, yes. How does that work? So they were automatics because mm-hmm. he was a state elected official, not right. because he was president of the United States, but rather because he was governor of Texas. And they did have assigned plots at the state cemetery, although in the wake of George's parents' deaths last year, they decided that it would be appropriate for them instead to be buried at the Bush Library in Dallas. So that is where they intend to be buried.
Okay.
For which there is space dedicated for that purpose.
Okay.
And so it makes sense.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, and as we kind of finish up this part two of our conversation, the one thing I want to mention that unfortunately, unless something changes, and I'm pulling every string, doing everything I can to make sure that the rest of the world gets to read Washington on Rye, which is because that's, you're also an author. But you know, I was so honored that of the friends and family that received, that got to read your book that you authored, which is your tales of childhood and your trip to D.C. and kind of the anecdotes that you collected during that time there. It is one of the coolest inside the Beltway, you know, it's so neat to get to read about some of the silliness, yet the magic that is Washington, because we hear it's easy to, you know, to kind of punch at Washington inside the Beltway, but it really is an incredible city where, I mean, it's like it or not, it's a city that pulls a lot of the levers that make this little ball of mud spin around that we call Earth. And that book is such a great portrait of your time there, having had been an eyewitness all the way from the governor's office to a senator's office, and then all your time inside the up close with presidents. And it was just, I really enjoyed the read. And I hope that the rest of the world will get to read Washington on Rye.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I had a Forrest Gump, Ferris Bueller kind of 33-year experience that I couldn't have scripted it any more overwhelmingly. And I'm still, you know, have a hard time believing it all happened, just in terms of the opportunities not only to meet, but also, more important, to get, you know, personally very well acquainted in many cases with these people who run the gamut while they're running the country, if you will. Not only in my governmental career, if you will, as a Senate staffer in the Reagan administration, but also in private practice through client representation, but also the theme that pervades this whole biographical account of my Washington years is the unlikely vehicle through which I made all of these friendships and acquaintanceships through tennis. Bjorn Borg, Steffi Graf, was my house guest for Washington, Charlton Heston, for God's sakes. Politically, it went from A to Z. I was lucky enough to play tennis all the time, across the board, from Teddy Kennedy to, right-wing Republicans, because tennis was their release. And then, members of the Supreme Court, some of whom are roughly contemporaries of mine now, but when we were kids, we were just a bunch of knuckleheads in Washington, ranging from, John Roberts, Chief Justice of the United States, Clarence Thomas, Senator Day O'Connor, former Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia was a tennis nut. It's just, and then the media types, they also, were tennis nuts, Britt Hume, and others. Apart from tennis, just the lucky experiences I had through client representation of Mary Tyler Moore, and Gene Stapleton, Edith Bunker, and all in the family, and Boone Pickens, he was in the news in the mid 80s, nonstop, Bill Marriott, one of the classiest gentlemen, on earth. And then just these episodic kind of acquaintanceships that I couldn't even imagine. Being on the phone with Milton Friedman to get his suggestions for candidates to be assistant secretary for economic policy at the Treasury in Reagan's first term. And then, of course, being in the same room and shaking hands with the likes of, Ronald Reagan. It was simply overwhelming. And if I could do it all over again, I wouldn't change, a day of it. But that's, it was a blessing manifold times. So that's the gist of Washington on Rye. But the point is that I wanted to explore and focus on the after hours lives of these people, not so much to write the umpteenth book on, you know, some bitter political feud of the day, but rather to illustrate what these people are like as people and after hours, and they're just people. And so you should respect that. And there's no reason that you should cross swords, which is a far cry from today's atmosphere.
I could not agree more. And you definitely do a good job with that. Now, one of the things I always ask my guests, Bayless, and I'm going to give a follow-up response to yours, but a lot of the people that you've interacted with, that you've called friend, even though we may or may not, like I may or may not have ever known them, we've heard of them. We have our own memories of them because they've helped. I mean, it's Ronald Reagan, it's George Herbert Walker Bush, et cetera. How, when this ride is all said and done, do you want to be remembered? What is the legacy that you're wanting to leave behind?
Well, that's a question I haven't thought about, but my reflex response would be to have been a helpful mentor to the next generation, if only to make a down payment in reciprocating the tremendous assistance and direction and guidance that the elder generation gave to me. So I think that there is a deep-seated, unavoidable obligation, personal obligation, to return the favor to those who helped you, who will no longer need your help. They didn't need it then, but you have an obligation to return the favor by helping the next wave. And I take tremendous delight and gratification in being the big brother or the surrogate dad to a great number of young people. And I think that there is a craving for that kind of mentorship among the 20-somethings today and college students. I spend a lot of time with that, but it is it's no time at all, because it's just so enjoyable for me, because there's a thirst out there for any younger generation to be guided by somebody who can serve as their helpful advance man in life.
Well, and it's I said before I asked you the question, it's really interesting how that tees up very nicely what I told you I would have a response to what you were going to say, which I generally don't with guests, but you're a little different than my normal Texas Titan guests. And that is that I would like to say, as one of those recipients of that pay it forward, that down payment. And the cool thing is, Bayless, I know I'm speaking for hundreds, if not thousands, of other individuals who you have poured into, who you picked up the phone, you followed up with an email, you opened a door, that proverbial job that we wanted, guidance we wanted, you were there. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, I have befriended a United States senator and been in his employ thanks to the guidance and the vouching of Jim Bayless. And, you know, so on behalf of all of us who have benefited from your mentorship, your friendship, and your wit, and your correction on etiquette
and grammar.
I know. I got to tell you, man. I'm like, when I write you a thank you note or send you an email, I'm more insecure than any other time in my writing. And I've written a book, you know. I'm like, but it's Bayless. It's like, you know, it's like writing to Pulitzer or something. So I know I got to get it right. But anyway, on behalf of all of us, man, thank you, Jim. But from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for your friendship and your mentorship. You mean the world to me.
Well, you're stuck with me. I'm so sorry.
I'll take it, my man. I'll take it. And hey, if ever there was someone deserving of the title of Texas Titan, it's you. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for you being on the show.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. I appreciate your endurance and patience with all of my shaggy dog stories.
I love it. And let's happy 2020 to you and Liz. Can't wait to see what it holds.
All right. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Before you go, I wanted to let you know where you can find us out there on the interwebs. You can go to show notes as well as listen to all the past episodes and look for upcoming shows at texttitans.blog. Also, that has all the different formats that you can listen to the show on if you go there. So texttitans.blog. You can also go to jasonrightnow.com. That has not only a link to the podcast, but it also has a link to my Make Your Own Rules blog that I think you'll enjoy. So please check that out. Also, it has information about my executive coaching business, speaking, and anything else like that. So jasonrightnow.com. That's literally just my name, jasonrightnow.com. On Twitter, I'm at jasonwrighttx. I would really appreciate a follow. I have not been a big Twitter user, so I need you guys to help me with that. So please take the time to go out to jasonwrighttx, find me, and follow me. I'm trying to get more active with it. And so if you'll engage with me, I'll try to do a better job of engaging with you. So I would appreciate that. And then on Instagram, I'd really appreciate a follow there. I'm at jasonrightnow. Again, my name, now. So please follow me on Instagram. And then on Facebook, I'm also at JasonWrightTX. So check us out there. I'm also on LinkedIn, so look for me there. I try to use as many platforms as possible to let you know about upcoming shows, past shows, and then also just anything that I find interesting. I'm trying to push it out and get better with the social media. So please check us out there and follow us. I would be most grateful. And also, please do not forget, it means the world to me for you to go to iTunes, give us a rating. Right now, we've got that 5-star rating. I'm hoping to hold that. Please, please, please. The comments that people are writing are so very kind. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. And that's how we keep moving up in the ranks. And right now, we're crushing it with downloads. The show has really had incredible feedback thanks to you guys. So I'm grateful. Please keep that momentum going by giving us a review on iTunes. Thanks so much and have a great day. And as always, I could not be more grateful for you listening. Thanks.